The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Today on the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy and ADF, Alliance Defending Freedom. The death of George Floyd in Minneapolis at the hands of a police officer touches off mayhem across America. Trump addresses the nation.
My fellow Americans, my first and highest duty as president is to defend our great country and the American people. I swore an oath to uphold the laws of our nation, and that is exactly what I will do.
Seeking to restore order, the president did not use his powers under the Insurrection Act, at least not at this point.
The president made clear yesterday he is prepared to use the Insurrection Act, as George Bush did in 1992 in the LA riots, as Lyndon Baines Johnson did in 1968 after the Martin Luther King riots.
And he had an argument to do so.
And now, again, for a week, we've seen on our TV screens thousands of insurrectionists and anarchists in close quarters destroying our cities.
I'm Hugh Hewitt. Great to be with you. Catch my program each weekday morning live, 6 to 9 a.m. Eastern Time, and on demand 24/7. Learn more at HughHewitt.com, and let me invite you to join us now by video. And follow me on Twitter, at Hugh Hewitt. Follow this program as well at Town Hall Review. It's been just over a week since the national powder keg blew up city after city following the police killing of George Floyd, an unarmed black man in Minneapolis. The police killing on Monday, May the 25th, didn't take long to boil over. It started with peaceful demonstrations, but then the violence, the looting, and the rioting followed hard thereafter, as if choreographed city after city. On Monday, the president spoke in the Rose Garden at the White House.
My fellow Americans, my first and highest duty as president is to defend our great country and the American people. I swore an oath to uphold the laws of our nation, and that is exactly what I will do. All Americans were rightly sickened and revolted by the brutal death of George Floyd. My administration is fully committed that for George and his family, justice will be served. He will not have died in vain. But we cannot allow the righteous cries and peaceful protesters to be drowned out by an angry mob.
Following the speech, the president walked, Bible in hand, to St. John's Church, the historic church in Lafayette Park that had just the night before been set fire to by rioters. Chris DeGaulle, my colleague in Philadelphia, spoke with White House Deputy Press Secretary Hogan Gidley from AM 990, The Answer.
And I wonder when that decision was made. It's funny. Of course, cable news predictably is out there trying to find anybody they can to chirp about it, including the, I guess, the Episcopal bishop or some such thing, leadership of the church chirping about her displeasure about the visit. When do you make decisions like that?
I think the president was really wanting to take a look at some of the damage up close and personal. It's a church that means a lot to him. Every president since Madison or something, has attended a service in that chapel, and it's right across the street from Lafayette Park, which is right across the street from the White House. So I can basically see the steeple, from the front of the building, and it's a symbolic church, somewhere that Abraham Lincoln prayed, one of the president's favorite past presidents, and he really wanted to go over there for its significance, and he also wanted to make the statement of how wonderful this country is. This wasn't going to happen again. We had to make sure that this country understands it is built on law and order. I've walked into work a couple of days, and I've seen the storefronts just collapsed. All the inventory just stolen. Businesses are suffering. The mom and pops who own these businesses are suffering as well. And so this is one of those poignant moments in a presidency and a snapshot in history in which the leader of the free world is standing up for those who can't stand up for themselves.
Hogan, I know that you all are five steps ahead of what the media is going to say at all times. I mean, you're well aware of how they're going to frame everything. I know you are. And I mean, Kaylee has been, you know, demonstrating that time and again that she's doing these press briefings in a way that I really like. She's basically, she anticipates what they'll ask and then lays them flat after they do it, which is fun to watch personally. But now we're in a deeply serious time, and I understand the minefield as a message you guys have to navigate, and the president has to navigate. I like, the president's been careful through coronavirus, and I think he's been careful now to not be the dictator the left has always claimed he is. He's resisted that, and it's funny to me that while he's allowed governors and mayors to lead, they're clearly showing, particularly in blue states, they don't know what the hell they're doing. They can't. And so he's forced to, at some point, act. He did so yesterday. The president doesn't want to be backed into militarizing the country to deal with this. He'd prefer mayors and governors do it. Right?
Right. He's called on them to do so. And in a time in which some of them can and some of them can't, the president steps in and says, we'll help you any way we can. And in this particular instance, I mean, you saw what was happening in streets across this country. You saw what was happening in, I mean, just egregious behavior that does nothing to honor the memory of George Floyd. His family called for peace. Called for protest, but for peace. And the president said many times, said it so eloquently, we stand with those who want to protest peacefully. Absolutely. That's a First Amendment right.
Following his Monday speech, the noise level began to abate ever so slightly around the country. Did the president's words of confidence begin backing down the mobs? I spoke with Senator and former military officer Tom Cotton. The president did a very good thing with his speech and with his walk to St. John's, because he was not just going to St. John's. He was going to every storefront that had been vandalized, to every small business that had been destroyed. That's what I thought that was. Blue check bubble people and orange man bad people had a collective stroke and said those poor demonstrators were the subject of rubber bullets, which I don't believe were used, and gas, which I think were flashbangs, not tear gas, but I'm not sure. I don't know. But it was after curfew. What did you think of the president's actions?
Well, I thought the president's remarks were entirely appropriate. Look, I think everyone is deeply disturbed by the video of George Floyd's wrongful death. And we all welcome the quick action by local authorities and the Department of Justice to investigate and to get justice in accordance with law. We also respect the right of peaceful protesters, but we can have zero tolerance for anarchists and insurgents, rioters and looters. And the president made that point, and he symbolically made that point by visiting St. John's Church, where every president has worshiped since James Madison, in which these insurrectionists had set on fire two nights ago.
I want to go to the more important thing. Detective Tom from Oakland, one of my regular callers, called this morning, and he said, look, the problem is going to get worse because the insurrectionists, the anarchists, know that they are not fully staffed. They don't have enough people. He said, if you've got a home invasion robbery, forget about it. We'll be there in a few days. That the military and the National Guard are needed to do in-depth protection of neighborhood coverage sort of thing so that the police can do their job. Are you getting a response to your call for the use of military to do that basically neighborhood protection job where necessary?
Yeah, so, Hugh, as the president made clear yesterday, he is prepared to use the Insurrection Act, as George Bush did in 1992 in the L.A. riots, as Lyndon Baines Johnson did in 1968 after the Martin Luther King riots. He has not yet invoked that because he hopes these governors will use their National Guard, along with federal law enforcement authorities, to have an overwhelming display of force. When you have that overwhelming display of force, the violence is reduced. That has to happen in every one of these cities. Or just, I mean, compare the news reporting from 2 weeks ago to what it is today. 2 weeks ago, the mainstream elite media in D.C. and New York were accusing governors in places like Georgia of human sacrifice because they were reopening barbershops, or killing grandma because you were going to allow people to go back to work with appropriate precautions. And now, again, for a week, we've seen on our TV screens thousands of insurrectionists and anarchists in close quarters destroying our cities. Have you heard a single one of these talking heads, of these empty suits on CNN or MSNBC, shaming all of those insurrectionists and anarchists for not keeping 6 feet apart.
A hugely important election is coming at us quickly. Many around the nation thought that the political consequences of this awful week could not be topped. The Democratic presumptive nominee wasted no time to try and take advantage of them.
The country is crying out for leadership. Leadership that can unite us. Leadership that brings us together. Leadership that can recognize pain and deep grief of communities that have had a knee on their neck for a long time. We have to be vigilant about the violence that's being done by this incumbent president to our economy and to the pursuit of justice.
I spoke with David Drucker, political correspondent at the Washington Examiner. What do you think the American people think about it?
Well, yeah, that's a really good question, Hugh. I think the bigger question is who the American people are going to blame. Because I can't imagine the American people are looking at the rioting and the mayhem and the criminality, and they don't have problems with it. And even people, you know, prominent people, the mayor of Atlanta, George Floyd's brother, that clearly are critical and upset about what happened to Mr. Floyd, have been imploring rioters to cut it out and for people to protest peacefully. There's a potential for a political backlash. I think the question is, against who, or there's a chance for a lot of political frustration, you know, but the question is against who, and I don't think that's something we can know at this early date. So I think things are very combustible, at least emotionally and politically. I just think the question is, what is the outlet going to be? You know, I spent all day yesterday talking to Republicans, trying to figure out, at least Republican insiders and strategists, how they thought this could play out politically. And of course, 2 weeks from now, a month from now, we'll have some new crisis. What they played out for me is a number of scenarios in which people could look to Trump for leadership. People could look to Biden for leadership. People could find both candidates wanting and feel fed up with both of them. And so I think it's too early to draw these kinds of conclusions.
Well, I'm not looking although I got to laugh. If people are looking at Joe Biden for leadership, they ought to look for me to, you know, catch patches from Baker Mayfield. That Joe Biden is going to be a figurehead. He doesn't have any energy.
I wouldn't discount the notion that people might see him as normal and stable and in a period of turbulence.
They might vote for him because he's not Trump, but they're not going to vote for him. Have you seen the enthusiasm numbers out of Gallup for him among Biden supporters who are very enthusiastic? With Trump, it's like 80%. With Biden, it's 25%. They're not excited about their nominee.
I get it. They both have their challenges. I think for Biden, there's a lot of potential and a lot of softness. I think we saw that in the ABC poll, which on its face looked good for Biden, but there showed a lot of opportunity and softness there that could really benefit Trump. So, you know, he's got a whole number of challenges. You know, I think for the president, the challenge is, can he appear reassuring and can he give people confidence that he can calm everything down?
Coming up,
the violence has gone against what is perceived to be the haves.
The curious slant the destruction has taken. When the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt returns in a moment. This COVID-19 crisis has been straining the limits of our constitutional system. Over the next few years, we'll see a generation of new and grounded policy leaders emerge. They'll be prepared at Pepperdine's Graduate School of Public Policy. Learn more about the deadline for application at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. The protests and the mob violence engulfed metropolitan areas across the nation, including Seattle, Portland, parts of L.A. Even the upscale city of Santa Monica was not spared. The affluent beach city was visited by what looked like a well-choreographed sequence. Legal, peaceful demonstrations that quickly morphed into rioting, destruction, and looting. My colleagues, Jen Horn and Don Dix at 870 a.m. The Answer in Los Angeles, caught up with Pete Peterson, dean of the Pepperdine School of Public Policy. Pete is a resident of Santa Monica.
Are you staying safe in Santa Monica?
Yeah, we are, Jen and Don. It's been an amazing few days here in Santa Monica, for sure.
There have been calls for your police chief to resign. Take us through Sunday and Monday, just what the last several days have been like for Santa Monica residents.
Yeah, well, Sunday morning started off as it does so often in these last months with video online church here in the morning with our Santa Monica church.
That's right. It's our new normal, right? We turn on the computer.
That's right. That's right. Then about 12:30, I took my daughter for a walk. We just walked down to Ocean Avenue. We live only about six blocks from Ocean Avenue, and started walking towards the pier. And I noticed that there were some police car lights going on, and as we got a little bit closer, I could see that the police, Santa Monica police, were setting up some barricades for the march that was going to happen right there on Ocean Avenue. We walked back to the apartment, turned the TV on, and basically sat transfixed for the next 4 or 5 hours to see what began as a peaceful march just completely degenerate. I drove through downtown on Monday on my way up to campus at Pepperdine, and to see just the radical changes there, from the graffiti to the blown out windows to the National Guardsmen standing on corners, just amazing what has happened here in the last 72 hours.
Well, as you were watching that coverage unfold, one of the things that struck me, I'm curious about your thoughts that ran through your mind as you watched this. We've spoken to you before about your work documenting the, I think in the top 60 universities, the indoctrination that happens at universities. We can also probably state with some certainty that that bleeds into K through 12 as well. Mm-hmm. As I watched these riots, I was struck by the number of young individuals that were participating in 20 to 25 young, mostly men. And I wondered what Pete Peterson would think about the impact that the education system has had in the mindset of people that think it's okay to go out and behave this way.
And I can tell you, Don said WWPT. He said, what would Pete think about this?
Yeah, no, seriously, your analysis about the education system has stuck with me ever since we interviewed you on that months ago. What thoughts do you have about the responsibility that our education system has had in its impact in the way that these kids have been acting?
Well, I think there's something about these particular protests when they've turned violent. The violence has gone against what is perceived to be the haves, right? And I tweeted out actually on Monday that this is in many ways the fulfillment of the haves versus the have-not mentality, which unfortunately is taught in too many schools. Right. I mean, you see even some of the graffiti that says capitalism is murder and capitalism is theft. And these
right.
this kind of mentality that drives the thinking of the young, that for those that may be financially successful, that somehow they got that through ill-gotten gains. We're seeing some of that now in the midst of the violent part of the protest. Now, there's obviously an extremely, and I know you two have been great at covering this, there's a very valid set of arguments
sure.
that are being carried forth in the protests. But when they've turned into the riots, that part of the riots, and certainly you see it in the graffiti across the country, there's this turn towards this anti-capitalism mantra that certainly is something that's being inculcated in our school systems.
Although China was a headline grabber 2 weeks ago due to its treaty violations in Hong Kong, most of our attention has been understandably directed elsewhere. But China has been far from quiet, engaging in grossly misleading media campaigns that take advantage of our misfortune. Congressman Mike Gallagher, a former Marine intel officer who sits on the House Armed Services Committee, was a guest on my program. My question is, during this 5 days, what has the Chinese communists been up to with their information operation?
Well, it's been a field day for them. And of course, throughout the coronavirus crisis, they have deployed what has been referred to as wolf warrior diplomacy. And this is a reference to the highest grossing Chinese movie of all time, Wolf Warrior 2, which, like Wolf Warrior 1, ends with the Chinese hero stabbing an American ex-mercenary to death after the American arrogantly says, you know, we will always be superior to you. So it's bound up in this notion, after a century of humiliation, of reasserting China's rightful superiority globally. And I think while we might see a lot of what Chinese diplomats are doing as very ham-handed and likely to turn people off, we have to recognize that at least domestically, there is a large audience they're playing to. And of course, in the last few days, we've seen Chinese officials go into overdrive in trolling their American counterparts with protest slogans like Black Lives Matter and I Can't Breathe, really propagating this on social media. Chinese state-run media is featuring stories about the double standards of the U.S. for supporting Hong Kong demonstrators. And of course, this comes at the worst possible time, which is the anniversary of Tiananmen Square. And so I think it's incumbent upon the anarchists in America, notably Antifa and others who are taking advantage of the peaceful protesters who have a right to protest and who are rightfully outraged, to stop what they're doing, because it's a bad look for America. And also, it does no justice to the cause that the peaceful protesters are out there. And certainly, I think all of us who follow U.S.-China competition need to grapple with this question of how do we convince our social media companies to hold the Chinese Communist Party apparatchiks and propagandists to at least the same standard they're holding the president of the United States. My argument to Jack Dorsey at Twitter was we should not allow government officials on Twitter when they deny their own citizens access to that platform. But Jack Dorsey did not respond to my letter. He just sent one of his underlings.
I actually had never heard of the movie until 2 minutes ago.
The original 2015 Wolf Warrior ends with the hero is named Leng Feng. His commanding general very subtly sums up the movie's message by saying, "Those who challenge China's resolve will have no safe place to hide." And that, I think, is really the transition we've seen, particularly under General Secretary Xi Jinping. It's to very aggressively challenge everybody around the world. He, in my opinion, feels like he has a window of opportunity here that ultimately will culminate. And I may get criticized for this, but this is what he said, in Taiwan's reunification with the mainland. Make no mistake, that is the legacy issue for Xi Jinping. And what we're seeing in Hong Kong, I think, is a prelude to that. And so I would recommend watching that. It's almost comical. The bad guy in both movies, they're, as I mentioned before, they're both American military, a Navy SEAL in one case, with cartoonish names. Clearly, I think this is a window into sort of culturally how some of these themes that Chinese diplomats are using actually play very well domestically.
Coming up,
she had attended a rally to open up the state, and he used that as a pretext to get her out of the press briefings because he didn't like the questions that she was asking and because he didn't want to be held accountable for his handling of the pandemic.
A dust up where the governor turns ugly. When the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt continues in a moment. Hey, thanks for listening to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Our podcast is sponsored by Alliance Defending Freedom. ADF provides help at no cost to those whose liberty is being violated, but they can't do it without your help. Call 800-691-8969. That's 800-691-8969. Or visit townhallreview.com. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. I'm Hugh Hewitt. J.B. Pritzker, governor of Illinois, is miffed at Amy Jacobson. Ms. Jacobson happens to be a reporter and host for Salem's 560 AM The Answer in Chicago, where she co-hosts The Morning Answer with Dan Propp. She was a regular attendee at the governor's press briefings, asking hard, very pointed questions. Then Amy was abruptly disinvited, whereupon she filed a lawsuit against the governor. Amy's counsel is Patrick Hughes, president of the Liberty Justice Center, which specializes in viewpoint discrimination cases. He was a guest on my program.
To me, it seems a pretty open and shut case of viewpoint discrimination and unconstitutional, but would you explain it to people?
Yeah, Hugh, that's correct. Governor Pritzker in Illinois had some of the most restrictive shutdown policies during the pandemic in the country. He was quick to close everything down. He's very slow to open things up while competitive governors in other states like Texas and Georgia and Florida are doing much better in handling the pandemic. And Salem and their journalist, Amy Jacobson, was asking him very tough questions about that. And at one point, she broke the story that while Illinoisans were being forced to stay at home by Governor Pritzker, his family and in some ways himself were traveling back and forth between different properties they owned, because he's a billionaire, in Florida. And then she broke the story, Amy broke the story, that he was traveling to Wisconsin while regular folks had to be quarantined in their homes. And right after she broke that story, the governor banned her from the press conferences. And he said specifically, he didn't even hide it, Hugh, that the reason was her political viewpoints and her sort of opinions on things. She had attended a rally to open up the state, and he used that as a pretext to get her out of the press briefings because he didn't like the questions that she was asking and because he didn't want to be held accountable for his handling of the pandemic. And as a result of that, Salem and Amy were extremely unhappy that their First Amendment rights were being violated, and they asked us to help out, and we agreed, and so we're suing to put her back in that press room because she has First Amendment fundamental rights to ask these tough questions of Governor Pritzker.
Now, Patrick Hughes, I've been teaching con law for 25 years in a First Amendment seminar for nearly as long. And for the benefit of the audience, the government may issue reasonable time, place, and manner restrictions, which when equally applied to everyone can be upheld. But you may not ever discriminate based upon a speaker's viewpoint. The government may not do that. It's actually kind of not even worth 30 minutes of class. It's like prior restraint. It's a basic ABC. So the only hole I could possibly see in your case, Patrick, is if the governor's lawyers were to return and say, oh, no, she's not barred. We're taking turns with people at the microphone or in the virtual chat room. Have they tried that technique?
They haven't tried it yet, and if they try it, it's going to fail. Look, they allowed her to be part of the press because Salem and Amy Jacobson are phenomenal journalists that have been asking these questions for a long, long time. And so for a while, for day after day, she was part of the press pool. Amy was part of it. And then they banned her, and she was the only one who was banned. And so it's going to be very difficult for them to make that argument. And I agree with what you said in the introduction to your comments, that this is a prior restraint. They don't want her to ask these questions. Governor Pritzker is not allowed to pick and choose what kind of coverage that he gets and which reporters get to ask him questions. Obviously, politicians, Hugh, hate when they are challenged, and Governor Pritzker, who's particularly thin-skinned and doing a particularly bad job of handling the pandemic in Illinois, now there are riots in the streets of Chicago, and he's doing a particularly bad job in handling that, doesn't want to be challenged. And Salem and Amy Jacobson were challenging him, and that's why he banned her.
By the way, I personally make more news than almost any other journalist in America. So when I read, as I know Amy makes news, which is almost the definition of a news station, is when you break news, when you make news, be it interviews or reporting. She does it often. When the governor described her as she used to be a reporter, but now she, game over, game, set, match. He has just demonstrated like the president doesn't like Acosta, but at least there they had the argument that they got a limited amount of space. There is no such argument in a virtual press room, is there, Patrick?
No, Hugh, there isn't. And that's why at Liberty Justice Center, we, you know, go after these types of actions. This is just complete and total government overreach. And like you just said, Governor Pritzker has admitted what his bias is publicly. He didn't even shy away from it. He didn't hide from it because he feels so insulated from getting criticism, and he feels insulated, particularly in the middle of the pandemic, from any consequence. And, you know, we think that that is wrong. We think that Salem and Amy have the right to ask any question so that the citizens of our state and our country can be informed in this unbelievable time that we're going through. And we feel very comfortable that the court's going to see it that way as well.
Coming up.
I know what it is to work hard and labor hard. And one thing that my folks taught me is that there are no jobs beneath me. As long as it's honest work, it's worthy of doing.
Senator Joni Ernst, daughter of the Heartland. When the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt returns in a moment. This COVID-19 crisis has been straining the limits of our constitutional system.
Over the next few years, we'll see a generation of new and grounded policy leaders emerge. They'll be prepared at Pepperdine's Graduate School of Public Policy. Learn more about the deadline for application at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with ADF, Alliance Defending Freedom. Joni Ernst is a first-term senator from Iowa, running for re-election now. She won first in 2014. Now she's running hard for that second term. Senator Ernst was brought up on a farm. Neither of her parents had been to college. But she went, and following college, she served in the military for 23 years before retiring as a lieutenant colonel from the Iowa National Guard. Her latest project has been a book telling her own story. The title, Daughter of the Heartland, an ode to the country that raised me. Senator Ernst was my guest on the Hugh Hewitt Show. There is quite a lot I did not know. Of course, I knew of your combat service. First female combat veteran to serve in the United States Senate. Also, I knew that the famous castrating hogs ad, and then on page 21, castrating hogs is one of those jobs nobody wants to do. You make reference to it in the book, but you really are a daughter of a farm in Iowa. I mean, you're the real deal, Senator Ernst. How many people are still shocked by that?
Well, a lot still are outside of the Midwest. But one thing that really resonates across the state is the fact that you've worn those work boots and you've done those types of activities as you're growing up as a kid on a farm. And all through my first campaign, as I was crisscrossing Iowa, all these different Iowans, they were like, yeah, you know, I used to do that when I was a kid, too. And yeah, I still do that today, you know, that kind of thing. But it really brings people together when they have shared roots, shared values. And just to understand that I know how to work with my hands. I know what it is to work hard and labor hard. And one thing that my folks taught me is that there are no jobs beneath me. Work is, as long as it's honest work, it's worthy of doing.
You know, Senator Ernst, this book is pretty candid. You're a victim of rape in your college years. You're also the victim of domestic abuse. Did you make a conscious decision? I'm just going to put it all out there in one book because it's really blunt.
Absolutely. And I just yesterday I had a friend ask me if I would have put all of this into a book if it hadn't been exposed going through my very public divorce. And likely not. Many of these stories were very personal and very challenging for me to talk about. It was hard to share those things with other members of my family that weren't aware of some of those certain situations. But the fact is, after, you know, all of the information came out through the divorce, I had so many women and a handful of men as well that reached out and said, Joni, I get you. I've been through these same circumstances. I had one woman that said, wow, you've gone through this, and yet you served as a battalion commander in the Iowa Army National Guard. You're a senator today. She said, you've overcome all of this. And she's like, you're an inspiration. And so I want people to know you don't have to be defined by the singular challenges that you experience in your lifetime. You can overcome those. You can set your own goals, and don't let the naysayers put you down out there. You've got to drive through it. You've got to make your way through it. And that's what I hope other young women will see as well, is that whatever has occurred in their lifetimes, you can get beyond it. You can set your goals and you can achieve them.
Trauma does not define people. That's what I take away from Daughter of the Heartland, is that Joni Ernst is really one of the strongest members of the United States Senate. I love having her on, but I had no idea about this level of trauma. I also did not know that neither of your parents went to college. Now,
no.
I think that's really remarkable, but they always made it clear you were going.
Right. And that is not uncommon, especially where I'm from Southwest Iowa, a very rural county. We have just a little over 10,000 folks that live in my county. Most of them will reside in the county seat there where I live in Red Oak. But many of the folks there have not gone to college, especially those of my parents' my parents' age. Now, we have a lot of wonderful community colleges in our area, and we do have some folks that will go on to four-year institutions and beyond. But truly, when you're living in the heartland, some of the best jobs that you can get are those technical jobs or those jobs related to agriculture. Technology in agriculture is really big, and I wanted to highlight that in my story as well. You know, when I was going to school, I worked really hard. I loved school. I would not miss a day of school. And so my parents really enforced in me, you know, you have the abilities, you will go to school. And it was just a matter of, okay, finding my way. How do I get to school? My sister has an associate's degree. She went to a community college in our area. My brother, well, he's one of those kids that probably best not to go to school. So he took a couple classes at a community college and decided that wasn't for him. So he works on a rail crew with one of the railroads. So it's just it doesn't define you again. You know, it's titles throughout my life. Titles, I'm not impressed by titles. And even wearing the title of senator, that's not really who I am. People back home call me Joni.
So, Senator, I call you Senator. I got to also tell you, I've never heard of Trixie Belden until I read Daughter in the Heartland. I've never heard of Trixie Belden. Now, I have a granddaughter who is a voracious bookworm like you describe yourself to be growing up. So I got to find out, is Trixie Belden still working? I mean, does it work for this young generation, for kids under seven and six and that sort of thing?
I think it would, because of the wonderful adventures that Trixie was always engaged in with her friends. And it's different because it's set in a different era. So, you know, they won't be talking on their smartphones to each other, that kind of thing. but certainly it is a great, great adventure. Clean stories. They're mystery stories. And if you have a child with an imagination, wonderful book.
That just charmed me. Now I want to get to a hard question. You're a veteran of the National Guard. You led a battalion in combat. Yesterday, Bill de Blasio said the National Guard couldn't help in New York City because they weren't trained. I was astonished by that. Wow. What's your reaction to that?
Well, I was a company commander when I served overseas and then went on to be a battalion commander later in the Iowa Army National Guard. And I can tell you just from my own experience in wearing the combat boots is that our National Guardsmen are some of the finest trained individuals. Whatever our National Guardsmen are involved in, they are the best.
For the complete Hewitt Ernst interview, go to www.townhallreview.com. Coming up.
Nobody's talking about protests. I'm talking about destruction, killing of cops, burning of cop cars. If this was not a dark day in Los Angeles Police Department history, perhaps it's darkest. I don't know what is.
Dennis Prager on a dark time for the LAPD in the final segment of the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. If you enjoy the Town Hall Review and you are a person of faith, let me introduce you to another podcast I think you'll like. It's the Christian Outlook. And in it, you'll hear the leading voices in the Christian world engaging the issue of the day. This week, Donald Trump looks to stop the mayhem.
The president has the full authority to protect the nation and call up federal troops to do that.
Blue states take the brunt.
Now we have all these cities that are falling apart, and they're all in liberal bastions.
Alveda King responds to celebrity.
Even for the Hollywood and the celebrities who are going to bail the looters and the rioters out, why don't they go and bail out some of those mom-and-pop African-American organizations who've been destroyed?
And pastors seek racial reconciliation.
Whether we have someone's knee on our neck or not, the global community is rising up and saying, I can't breathe.
We've got all this and more. To subscribe, go to ChristianOutlook.com. That's ChristianOutlook.com. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Dennis Prager is a friend and a colleague at Salem Media Group. He often makes this observation on his show, everything the left touches, it destroys. His most recent illustration comes from this past weekend in the wake of all that transpired in Los Angeles. Here's Dennis.
There is a video up Twitter, actually. I am getting inured, though I'm not fully inured because I love this country too much, but I am getting used to seeing things that betoken a declining civilization. The burned out police cars of the Los Angeles Police Department is a video that shows America at its nadir. When the police of any democracy are attacked with impunity, when people feel free to write F the pigs on police cars, that's a declining civilization. The hysteria in the newspapers about police brutality, of course it exists. How could it not exist? Is there a police force on earth that only has angels? This is a moment of clarity. It's the only good thing about it. It is a moment of clarity. This is what the left hath wrought. And now they're double downing. Oh, it is all racism. It is all this racist country. The systemic racism. That's what your kids are going to get massive doses of. This anti-American hate that comes from the left. Anti-American hate. I want to have an acronym for it. AAH. It will now be AAH squared. New Yorker, an American uprising. Who really is the agitator here? In the sick, perverse world of the left, the agitator is Donald Trump, not the rioters and arsonists. As long as police are constructed of human beings, there will be some who are bad or engage in bad. It's like when it's safe. What is the meme that we have up at PragerU? Something I came up with years ago. When it's safe means never. So too, until police brutality stops, means never. You can lessen it. We should lessen it. But it won't stop. Nobody's talking about protests. I'm talking about destruction. If this was not a dark day in Los Angeles Police Department history, perhaps it's darkest. I don't know what is. You have to see it. Just car after car burned out. The thugs won.
Thank you for joining us for the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Catch up on earlier episodes at our website, townhallreview.com. And sign up for a daily dose of the best in talk radio. Special thanks to executive producer Russell Schubin, producer Charlie Richard, David Posian, Michael Cook, Adam Ramsey, and Dwayne Patterson. Let me say thanks once again to our sponsors, the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy and ADF, the Alliance Defending Freedom. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Thank you for joining us.